This is Professor Allen, and welcome to The Quarter Bit. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue from my comic book collection, or two, which I will select sort of at random, unless listeners really want me to talk about something. Any comic books from my collection are eligible, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for them. Were the issues worth 25 cents? Were they bargains at 25 cents? Or were they still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 124th episode of The Quarter Bin, we will be looking at Dakota North 2 and 3 by popular demand from Marvel Comics, cover dated August and October 1986, respectively. But first, a little feedback. We've done this a few times on Short Box Showcase, and that is that the first bit of feedback is from me. Well, I mean, it's not really feedback. It's just an update and an oversight. And that is that I failed to mention that the source of the four Adventure Comics issues that we covered recently in the Dial Q for Quarterbin event, I wanted to note where I found those. Now, I don't normally do this on the podcast, although I do try to do that on the blog post for the episode. But anyway, I wanted to shout out that those four books all came from the massive Quarter Bin area at last year's Akron Comic-Con. Now, last episode, we did wrap up that Dial Q miniseries, and Slangword Scott said that this has been a particularly fun series of podcasts. Thank you. Well, you're welcome, Scott, and thank you for the kind words. Dr. Ange continued to attempt to make his case when he retweeted the episode. He did so with the message, #SpinningJenny, for the win. While I was putting this episode together, Bendis teased that a former Dial H character would be coming back to his superbooks, and I think we all agree that if it is in fact Spinning Jenny, Dr. Ange will be insufferable. And from Zoom Yukinori, the Done in One Wonders podcast Wonder Show, loved these episodes, looking forward to hearing the final installment. Well, I hope you enjoyed that, Zoom. Sir Martin said that this has been a great podcast miniseries. What's the next special event, he wonders. Actually, Sir Martin, if you can wait till the end of the episode, I'll sort of, kind of, answer that question. Last episode received social media love from the people mentioned above, and Sir Iowa's Joe Crawford, Mike Peacock from Justice's First On, Mike Zumo of the Man of Screen podcast, Robert Ludwig, Alexander Asias, Old School Ross, Christopher Ouellette, Kyle Pettit, Justin Steiner, Warlord Worlds, Sean Ross from the Secret Wars and Beyond podcast, Luke Giaconetti of Earth Destruction Directive, Michael Sheu, artist Lauren Skinkis, Clinton Robinson of Coffee and Comics, Mike Garvey of DCOCD, Con L, Christopher J. Warden, the Gal Walks Into a Comic Shop podcast, Dave's Comic Heroes blog, Billy Hogan of the Superman Fan podcast, Al Sedano of Resurrections, the Adam Warlock and Thanos podcast, Vinny Gianfredi III, Michael Allen Carlyle of the Crap Box of the Son of Cthulhu, and Laurel, a.k.a. Mountain Flower One. Thank you for all that social media support. And now, we have a couple comic books to cover. Dakota North 2 and 3 each had cover prices of 75 cents, meaning I acquired these comics at reasonable enough, decent 66 and 2/3% discounts off that original cover price. The cover of Dakota North number 2 by Tony Salmons. Now, his name comes up a lot in this episode, and I'm going to go with pronouncing the L, Salmons, as opposed to the plural of the fish. But I have no idea which way is correct. I'm just going to try to be consistent. Anyway, the cover by the man who I'm going to call Tony Salmons shows Dakota driving a hot red sports car with no top. The car has no top. Get your minds out of the gutter. She, with a top, is driving a car without a top into a crowded area with a huge monster truck bearing down on her and her passenger, who does not look happy with the situation. And Dakota, being Dakota, is waving a gun around, which does mean that the Marvel version of New York has slightly more permissive views of the Second Amendment and gun laws than real-world New York does. But as a cover, this is dynamic, exciting, a little wacky, and to be fair, spoilers, this sort of does happen in the issue. Now, I don't require that from my covers, but when it does occur, I consider it a nice little bonus. The story in issue 2 is Pet Tricks by Martha Thomases with art by the aforementioned Tony Salmons. We start with Dakota in a little black cocktail dress, heading with her brother Ricky to the Rainbow Room to meet their dad, and on the way, a crossbow arrow nearly strikes her, thunking into the building. Again, a minor difference with the real world, because in our world, crossbows don't shoot arrows, they shoot bolts. The more you know. There is a note attached to the crossbow bolt, warning her away from the meeting, away from this potential new client. Inside, Dakota and Ricky meet SJ, their dad, and SJ's former CIA friend, George Cooper, who seeks Dakota's services. Cooper needs a bodyguard as he begins a tour promoting his new memoir. The meeting gets off to a rocky start before the handsome Timas comes and asks Dakota to dance. Anything to get away from this conversation. She quickly realizes that Timas himself was the would-be crossbow assassin. She tries to question him, but he quiets her with a big old kiss right on the mouth, which distracts her and sets him up for a very nasty hashtag MeToo situation here a mere 32 years later. Dakota announces to her table that she is taking the case, showing them the crossbow bolt and telling them about Timas, but not about the kissing part. At the table, Cooper, the CIA vet, has lost a gold pen to Ricky in a poker match, and Ricky zips right out of there with his winnings. As the others leave the restaurant, Dakota fights off some armed men attacking Cooper. Cooper's publicist arrives to discuss the day's interviews. And then suddenly, Cooper's car explodes, shocking them all. Somebody clearly is not happy with the man monetizing his security clearance. Dakota rushes him to the subway where he confesses that the pen he lost to Ricky in the poker match, he actually lost to him on purpose to get the pen off of his person, because the pen is full of an experimental nerve gas, and that's why bad guys are after him. The baddies had gotten Cooper's entire itinerary from his publicist, but that was just an accident. On the street, Ricky is approached by an older woman. And by older, we mean 16-year-old model Daisy Kane, who asks him to accompany her to the airport, and she shamelessly flirts with him all the way. All of this is at the behest of the evil Cleo Vanderlip, who we met in issue 1 and is Dakota's mortal enemy. Daisy convinces Ricky to go to Europe with her, which I'm guessing wasn't that hard to do. Did I mention that she's 16 and that he is an unspecified age younger than that? Now, let me just stop to interject. It was 1986. Things were a little different back then. Okay, back to this wildly inappropriate story. Now remember, for what it's worth, that this story was written by a woman. Not that that makes it better, but I do think maybe it makes it less bad. And I did check, Eddie Braganza had nothing to do with this issue, or Gerard Jones. In Central Park, Timas again attacks Dakota, this time with a blade to her throat. He hashtag MeToos her again right on the lips again, warning her off the case, in case she missed the first time that he forcibly engaged in intimate contact with her. But not scared off one iota, Dakota and Cooper drive uptown in the inconspicuous candy apple red convertible from the cover, and Tomas tries to run them down in a monster truck. The former CIA man is terrified, which is a bad sign when you think about it. Dakota evades by scooting up a sidewalk, causing Tomas to crash. He ends up in the hospital. The next morning, and that's kind of an important detail, actually, Dakota gets news that Cooper's first check to her has cleared. And it's at this point, hanging out with Amos, Mad Dog, Cooper, and SJ, that they all realize that Ricky is missing and has been for about a full day. Impressive family dynamics there. And in the final splash page, our young people are holding hands, staring at the Eiffel Tower. The end. Now let's roll right into the next issue here. We'll do our analysis and discussion afterwards. The cover of Dakota North 3, again by Tony Salmons, shows a close-up of Dakota's face, one eye squinted, the other staring down the barrel of her pistol. It's bold, dramatic, and definitely eye-catching. The story of Issue 3 is Active Tense, again, by Martha Thomas's, with art again by Tony Salmons. We start by being reminded that Ricky North just had a really big day, meeting teen model Daisy Kane, who despite being 16, is in fact older than he is, and she talked him into going to Paris with her. He thinks it's because he's such a charming guy. Actually, it's because Ricky carries a pen with experimental nerve gas. He doesn't know this, but Daisy does. Dakota is furious at Ricky for being missing, an anger which seems to me to be a bit misplaced. SJ tells her the news that Ricky has been seen in Paris, and she rushes off there. She asks Mad Dog to contact Yvonne, who runs her office in Paris. In Paris, with few resources, Ricky wants to find his dad's ally, Guy Beaumountain, so they can get some cash. Ricky and Daisy listen to the guy's long stories at lunch, but rush into the subway when they get the chance. Aboard the plane, Dakota considers her life's direction, until the assassin, Mr. Gray, attacks her in the plane's lavatory, which were evidently way larger in 1986 than they are today. Like, really big. Anyway, she manages to grab her plastic boot knife, leaving him unconscious in there. Pretty sure she would be on a terrorist watch list by now, you know, these days, but hey. This was 1986. Dakota rushes off the plane as soon as it lands, meeting Yvonne and learning that there are offers for her to return to the modeling life. They meet with SJ's contact, Guy Beaumountain, who tells them that he did see the pair at lunch and that Daisy had her eyes on Ricky's pen. Frustrated by all of this, Dakota goes shopping. I think it's important at this point to remind you, written by a woman. The next day, after lunch with Yvonne, Dakota sees Ricky on the street and rushes after him to the famous Pompidou Museum. In an earlier scene, Daisy had given him tickets to the tourist attraction, but he just keeps on walking, listening to his museum headphones as he plays with the pen. As she rushes into the museum, she sees a security guard shot by an assailant who then opens fire on her. She rushes away on a catwalk outside the museum, which was one of the features of the iconic building. She manages to trip the shooter and hang him from the roof with a rope. When he confesses that Cleo Vanderlip hired him, he attacks with a knife and ends up cutting his own ropes and falling several stories. Dakota climbs back up, making up a story for the guards. She tries stopping Ricky from getting on a train with Daisy, yelling, "Then it's a trap!" And in the last panel, Daisy tells him, "Come sit next to me, lover. It's a long ride. Maybe you can write me a poem with that fancy pen of yours." The end.
Hello there. This is Jared Albrick, a.k.a. the Yard Sale Artist, with a quick podcast promo for my show, Comics with Normies. Here's how the show works. Using my yard sailing skills, I acquire a random comic book from a yard sale. I then give said random comic to a normie, a normie being a person who doesn't normally read comic books. Then, on the show, I'll sit down with the normie to discuss the issue, get a real outsider's point of view, and see what some of the comics that we love, and maybe not love so much, seem like to those normal folks we see walking around on the streets each day. It should be a fun perspective and good for a few laughs. You can check out the Comics with Normies podcast, along with some other fun-filled podcasts from White Rocket Entertainment, on iTunes and at whiterocket.podbean.com. And feel free to join the show using Twitter handle at Normies Podcast or on Facebook at Comics with Normies. Once again, you can find Comics with Normies on iTunes and at whiterocket.podbean.com. We'll see you there.
And we're back. So where the listener requests that we got for more Dakota North after covering issue 1 back in January on episode 113, was that a good idea? Remember, this wasn't my idea. I'm merely bending to the will of the people. I'm just the host. You can't pin all this on me. If this was a terrible idea, I'd blame the listeners. I'd blame you. But fortunately, this was a pretty fun couple of issues. Continuing the ongoing tale of Dakota North and her rocky relationship with the evil Cleo Vanderlip and trying to learn to relate better with her relatives. These two issues are fast-paced, action-packed issues. We do a little globetrotting in this one, have a shootout and a fight, car explodes, there's international intrigue, spy stuff, a secret weapon. It's all right there. And the story never really stops. It just keeps rolling along. And although that's mostly a good thing, I think that is one of the problems to the pacing. We have two issues, and they were actually bi-monthly issues. The book was bi-monthly at this time. So in the course of 4 months, that is the 2 month wait for issue 2 and the 2 month wait for issue 3, about 3 days of time have passed. And there's something weirdly unsatisfying about that. I can't really put my finger on it, but the fact that so much time has passed, although adding to that quick pacing, it also adds to the fact that this is kind of a small story. Even though the stakes are high and there is an international component, it feels kind of small, because we're so involved in the minute-to-minute, hour-by-hourly machinations. And maybe there's a bit of a genre mismatch that I'm sensing here, that this can't decide if it's a detective story, you know, a PI story, or if it's an international thriller of the Mission Impossible James Bond variety, because it's a little bit of both. And another problem I have is related. As much as I like Dakota North as a character, as a tough dame, as a fighter, as a bodyguard, as a good shot, one thing we don't see her do in these issues was any investigating, any detecting. And it's not because she didn't have the opportunity. She arrived in Paris with a few of her father's connections and then, well, first she goes shopping, and then the next morning she begins to look for her younger brother. But she doesn't follow any clues. She just literally happens to run into him. There's no reason given in the story for her to be in that part of town near the museum. There were a lot of words in this book, and that's not a bad thing. But a line or two about why she was near the Pompidou, maybe something that came out of a, you know, an interview, a questioning, some document research, some investigation, something related to her job expertise. That's all I needed. Finding him based on just stumbling across him in sort of a dumb luck sort of way, to be honest. I'm not so enamored of that plot point. And even if they're trying to turn Dakota into an international woman of mystery, a super spy of some kind, the cover does say Dakota North Investigations. That's what she's supposed to be doing, and she just doesn't do much of it. What she does, I like. I want to emphasize that. There's just a little disconnect there, at least to me. I can't remember where I heard this comment from, but someone said that the cell phone has killed the private investigator genre, or at least has relegated it to the category of the period piece. In this case, a smartphone would have radically changed the story, from making it pretty easy to locate Ricky in Paris and communicate with him, even with his headphones on. Or if you do a PI story these days and place it in the current days, you need a super hacker on the team. Obviously, it would have been easy to hack into the flight manifests and find out where Ricky was landing, for example. Assuming at his young age he could have even gotten on the plane, but that's another story. You know, it seems like every mystery these days is a tech mystery. But I like these older school throwback types of stories, even when, like this one, they weren't considered throwbacks when they were originally written. And we've talked about the awkward, the borderline icky stuff, the ages of the teenaged international tourists, the fact that Daisy is, I was going to say, dispatched by Cleo to hang out with Ricky and flirt with him and charm him, but let's call it what it was. The fact that Daisy is pimped out by Cleo to hang out with Ricky and all that. As a condition of her employment, it seems. Now, there are a range of laws about child workers, probably even freelancers like Daisy, I suppose, would be. And what a 16-year-old can and cannot do in terms of hours and working conditions and all that stuff. So if they can't get Cleo on an international terrorism charge related to trying to get that secret gas weapon that's inside the pen and all that, they can tie her up forever in employment law violations, a little like Al Capone and tax evasion, I guess. But sometimes law enforcement agencies got to do what they got to do. Now, over my 11th grade spring break, which was just a few years ago, I took a school trip to London and Paris. And one of the things we did in Paris was visit the Pompidou Museum, which at that point had only been open a few years. And that was a few years before this comic took place. So Dakota had yet to spray bullets all over the place, or let's go with let that fella fall from his perch on the catwalk. Nothing was said about that character after this. Tomas, we know he ends up in the hospital. I'm thinking that this other guy, the catwalk guy, he may have ended up 6 feet under. But anyway, the Pompidou is a very distinctive building. When we were there, it was described to us as an inside-out building. The ductwork, pipes, elevators, all of these things are either visible from the outside or actually on the exterior of the building. So it's a dramatic design, and it still stands out as a uniquely artistic structure in Paris. Now, I had not thought about that building for many a decade, but as soon as I saw it, I knew immediately where Dakota and Ricky were. Issue 2, of course, gave us the Eiffel Tower as a visual clue that we were in Paris. And sure, that's a cliche, but they don't linger on it. I give both Thomas's and Salmon's a lot of credit for using the unique characteristics of the Pompidou to tremendous effect in this story, the issue 3 story. And that's a great idea because it is a uniquely Parisian locale, but it's not the stereotypical Parisian locale. As a writer, Thomas uses the catwalks as a great location for the ending scenes of the issue, and even uses the museum's audio tours as an excuse for why Ricky can't hear Dakota yelling at him. That's what he's listening to on his headphones. Really well-handled and executed scenes there at the end of issue 3. And Salmons just nails the exterior design. He is spot on in getting the look of the place just right. Those pages at the Pompidou were a definite highlight of these two issues, which were, all things considered, pretty good. By the way, there were also some subplots about the modeling and the fashion side of the business that I just skipped over for the synopsis because I wanted to cover the action-oriented stuff. But those were nice character beats, adding to fully more realize, flesh out the world of this series. The verdict. On Dakota North 2 and 3, sure, a few little nitpicks here and there. Nitpicks that I think are legitimate, that are actual downsides to the story. And again, the weirdly dated 1980s gender stuff, that's a legitimate issue. But the story itself, the plot, and the strength of the cast, and the dialogue, and the action, the settings, they all add up to make a pair of very interesting and enjoyable issues. Like I said before, mysteries are something I enjoy. I don't need my comics to contain superpowered beings in flashy costumes. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But if you're someone who doesn't mind straying from that most popular of genres when you're reading comic books, Dakota North is not a bad place to land. These are both solid quarter bin deals. And that wraps up my coverage of Dakota North 2 and 3, bringing the quarter bin portion of this episode to a close. But I picked up another Dakota North issue a while back for a little more than a quarter, so it's not official coverage. Calm down, Shag. Stella, sit down. It's bonus coverage. And we'll get to that super special coverage right after this.
Here at Quark's, customer satisfaction is our primary concern.
I'd say we just found our way into a wormhole.
I'm Kira Norris.
Lieutenant Commander Worf, reporting for duty, sir.
You're the best crew any captain ever had. This may be the last time we're all together.
This will shortly become a leading center of commerce and of scientific exploration. And for Starfleet, one of our most important posts.
It is quite simply, Commander, the journey you have always been destined to take.
Sensors are not functioning.
We've lost all contact with the space station.
What the hell is happening out there?
Shields up. Damage report.
Battle stations.
I'm Captain Benjamin Sisko. Welcome to Deep Space Nine.
Listen to the Prophets, a Deep Space Nine Two True Freaks presentation with Sean Engel and Andrew Layla.
And now with 100% more Paul Spataro.
And we're back. Again. I picked up Dakota North number 5 from Half Price Books at the enormously high price of $1. Meaning I acquired this book at a 33% premium on that original cover price. Remember, this is how much I love you, you lovely listeners. And Shag, too. I mean, I've met him. Lots of adjectives come to mind, but not lovely. Anyway, I love the rest of you 75 cents more than usual. That's the important part for you to remember here. I hope you appreciate the sacrifice I made on this one. Now, look, I wouldn't call myself a hero, but if that's the word that comes to mind to you, you know, that's totally your call. But that is why this is here in the bonus part of the episode, because I realize that a dollar is in fact way more than a quarter. It's like 4 times more. Trust me on that one. I'm a finance professor. But let's overlook that absurd cost and take a look at this issue, assuming we will be able to fill in the blanks from the unavailable issue number 4. The cover of Dakota North number 5, again by Tony Salmons, shows a glamour shot of Dakota. She's in profile, her skirt cut high up her thigh, her hair flying in the wind. Maybe she's just turning her head really fast. It's been a long time since I've had enough hair to do that, so it's kind of hard for me to tell. And of course, she's holding her sidearm, because that's what Dakota does. Issue 5, Cats Among the Pigeons, was of course written by Martha Thomases with art again by Tony Salmons. We start in Switzerland. I think that's part of what we missed in issue 4. With Dakota, Ricky, and Amos all tied up, being held by Sheik Ibn Beek, which I think we also missed in issue 4. The Sheik, by the way, has a falcon on his arm, complete with that big, thick arm glove for the falcon to perch on. Now, he wants the deadly nerve gas, which I guess is still in the pen. People know it's still in the pen, but the pen has not yet been located. From what I can tell, Dakota is blaming Ricky and Daisy, or your fashion model girlfriend, for getting them into this particular little conundrum. Back at the New York office, SJ and Cooper argue about Dakota and Ricky's fate while Mad Dog struggles to get work done, looking into Cleo Vanderlip. SJ cringes at the name. I thought she was dead. If she's involved in this, then heaven help us all. The Sheik furiously sends Brutus the Falcon to attack Dakota, but she manages to duck it at the last second, despite being tied to a chair. The bird flies at her again, Ricky sarcastically asking her to be quiet while he watches the Hulk on TV. The bird tears open Dakota's pants as the Sheik and his men laugh. Then she manages to arrange herself so the claws slash through her ropes. She kicks Brutus, who had flown again right at her. Dakota manages to break the leg off her chair and knocks the bird out of the air. High above the Atlantic, Daisy regrets how poorly she treated Ricky. He was different from most of the guys in the fashion industry. He was nice. Just wanted to hang out with her. At Cleo's office, she is pleased with her revenge on SJ that it's finally happening. Although she is concerned that the Sheik hasn't captured the pen yet. Her designer Luke comes in to show her his new designs, but they're all based on Dakota, and she blows her stack. Back in Switzerland, the Sheik is furious that Dakota managed to defeat his falcon. He grabs Ricky and puts him and his chair in a big pool of water that just happens to be nearby because, well, you got me on that one, I'm going to be honest. I have no idea where that big bucket of water came from. Nonetheless, he grabs a TV and threatens to drop it and electrocute Ricky because a guy who has a falcon, he ain't kidding around. Fortunately, Dakota jumps at Ricky and knocks him free. The Sheik draws a gun, determined to end things, but Amos trips him, causing the Sheik to drop the TV and electrocute himself. I, caramba, I did not see that coming. This is a pretty impressive scene, from the falcon attack to the TV electrocution. It is all a wow. Dakota frees Amos and Ricky, and they jump at the others. Ricky reveals that he hid the pen in the pocket of one of his guards, which is why nobody could find it on him or Dakota or Amos. Ricky grabs the pen back and forces them all to drop their guns or he will break the pen open. The trio rushes out to find a car to escape in. Back in New York, SJ rushes off to confront Cleo. She draws a gun and taunts him about his dead wife, Caroline. Cleo dismisses her guard, David, saying SJ is not worth worrying about, that he's not going to hurt her. As Dakota's team hops into a yellow sports car to get away, Ricky doesn't notice one of the men stealing the pen back from Ricky and heading back upstairs to the Sheik's area. Amos kisses Dakota as Ricky notices the pen is gone. The Sheik, who evidently survived the electrocution, I'm saying it was because of that big falconer's glove that maybe grounded him somehow, okay? That really doesn't matter because he and his men fight over the pen and they break it open, setting the gas free. By the time Dakota is back up there to re-nab the pen, she finds them all dead. Even the Sheik. Like, this time, he's really dead. The group returns to the USA and are greeted by Mad Dog and Cooper. SJ is still hanging out with Cleo. She's trying to convince him, with her feminine wiles, that she is not Dakota's enemy. But SJ pretty much knows better. And at the end of the story, back at the office, the doorbell rings and Daisy enters, asking if she can stay there for a while. I'm so scared. Hide me, please. And at the bottom of that last page, we read, this is where we usually put the blurb for the next issue. If there was a next issue, but there isn't. The cancellation appears to have been last minute because the replies on the letters page from Martha Thomas's and the editors seem to indicate that more stories are to come. Now, as was mentioned in the feedback after episode 113, Dakota appeared a couple times before being a member of the cast for the Cage series, which is about 6 years after this. After that, she was a supporting character in Daredevil, starting around like issues from the 80s to the 120s, and then after the renumbering, because Marvel, those continued from about issue 500 to 510 or so. That was about 10 years ago, with a very few appearances since then. This five-issue series, along with four of the Daredevil issues and about five other books, were collected earlier this year in 2018 into the trade paperback Dakota North, Design for Dying. That title, Design for Dying, you may recall, was the title of the story in issue one. I read the one-page introduction that Martha Thomas's wrote for that collection, which was interesting, but I like the last line most. I'm pleased she's back. Hope you are too. I think we all are. I am very glad that they were able to wrap up this storyline with the pen and the nerve gas, that came to a conclusion. Obviously, there are plot threads and character beats that could be ongoing, but this does serve as a reasonable end to the storyline, and all things considered, a reasonable end to the title. I wish it had gone longer, I suppose, but I'm really glad that she got a second life after this issue, maybe a third life too. With Marvel Comics, a character is never gone forever. I'm still waiting for White Tiger, the female one, the one we covered years ago on Shortbox Showcase, and Moon Knight to appear in the streaming Marvel world, and maybe Dakota North can join them. Look, when Disney takes over the streaming on their own service, they're gonna need new content, new shows to produce. Hello? There is a wackiness in this issue, of course, with the electrocution, non-electrocution, and the pen being stolen and restolen, then unstolen, and then whoops, finally used, and everyone's dead. But any villain with a Falcon is a pretty cool villain. Let's just admit that. And the scene with her fighting the bird off, getting out of the chair that she was tied to, that's a great scene. Like I've said before, throughout these issues, I can't really speak to her investigative prowess, but I can attest that Dakota North is one pretty impressive fighter and one tough mutter. Really enjoyed reading all of these, and I thank the listeners, or at least the feedbackers, for such positive reactions to issue one. See, I can be responsive, despite what my wife says. I also wanted to give special thanks to the Marvel unofficial app, MarvelUnApp.com, for providing synopses that form the starting points for some of my work in this episode. And now, having covered issue 5 as a bonus, and issues 2 and 3 as official picks, that almost brings Quarterbin episode 124 to a close. But almost. Because now, finally, I'm getting around to answering the question by Sir Martin of Grey way back at the start of this episode. Which, by the way, is one of the benefits of being a knight of the relatively geeky roundtable. He basically asked what was coming up on the quarter bin in the near future, and I'm going to basically answer that question. And that question of his set me to do some planning and some randomizing and selecting and deciding what we'll be doing in the next handful of episodes. So next time in episode 125, we will go where no episode of this podcast has ever gone before, as we cover Star Trek Telepathy War number 1 from Marvel Comics, November 1997. And since that episode number is easily divisible by 25, well, that means something. Now, of course, for episode 129, we'll be getting back to the Marvel Magazine series, this time with issue number 3 of that great reprint title. That leaves us 3 episodes in between, 126, 127, and 128. And I figured it'd be fun to do a Marvel, a DC, and an Indie for those 3 episodes. And again, I randomized the order, and for 126, it's going to be an Indie. And I randomized among the Indies in the quarter bin database, and I landed on an issue number 1 from Valiant from the 90s. That's all I can say. For 127, I'm going to run a Twitter poll from among a handful of Marvel issues that were randomized. That voting will happen shortly after this podcast episode that you're listening to right now, shortly after it goes out within a couple days. And that will be on the Relatively Underscore Geek Twitter feed. For 128, I randomized among the DCs, and I got a special, which I assume is oversized, from 1986. Now, looking ahead a little further, there are 2 things I can say about episodes starting in the 130s. One, in or near February 2019, Em and I are going to do a pair of themed, related episodes on Shortbox Showcase, or at least we're planning to do that. And if that does happen, according to that plan, I will also do a related episode over here. So depending on how the calendar falls with these prior episodes I've mentioned, that one could be slotted in wherever, so a minor rearrangement of the numbering could occur to get that in the right time frame. I'm also going to do another Dead Universe miniseries in that time frame. We're talking maybe 8 or 10 episodes from now. We've covered Ultraverse, The New Universe, Vertigo, and Amalgam. I think I know which Dead Universe that will be that we'll cover next, but it's way too early to announce. But very broadly speaking, that is where the podcast is going for the next 10 episodes, or so the next, like I say, 5 or 6 months or whatever. So, all right. Thanks for asking, Sir Martin. And now, we're done. If you have any questions or comments about this issue, or the episode, the podcast in general, or the future plans of the podcast, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the quarter bin.
The Quarter Bin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Shortbox Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening.
Professor!